thank you for tuning in to another episode of Targeted Talks. I'm your host, Jordan Sava. In this episode, I'm speaking with Dr. Suzanne Warner of the Mayo Clinic on some of the recent advances in the liver cancer field, as October is Liver Cancer Awareness Month. Thank you for joining me today to talk about the latest updates and developments for patients with liver cancer. To start, would you discuss what the current treatment landscape looks like for HCC?
Right now.
Oh, sure. This is one of my favorite conversations to have. So there is a lot on the menu for patients who are newly diagnosed with HCC. And really what's on the menu depends entirely on the staging of the patients when they present. It depends on two things. First, the staging of the cancer, but the staging of the cancer is dependent upon the actual state of the patient's liver. So what kind of condition their liver is in. The staging criteria we use most typically for HCC is a little bit different than what we use for other cancers. So other cancers, you say stage 1, 2, 3, 4. Liver cancer is a special breed, and we do 0 ABC. So that's the BCLC classification, 0 ABC. And one thing that I find very interesting about liver cancer and liver disease specifically is that the cancer can be very good, but if the liver is very bad, then the whole situation is very bad. And that's what I wind up telling a lot of patients, even with other types of cancers, is that if your liver is diseased, it becomes the star of the show, no matter what else is happening in your body. So a lot of our treatment options are a function of the patient's liver disease itself. So I would start by saying we have a mix of therapies that are available. And we have kind of curative intent therapies that are directed just at the tumor that we can see. We have therapies that are directed at the tumor that we can see, but are really designed to kind of kick the can down the road, for lack of a better term. And then we have systemic therapies that can be used in a variety of different ways. And that I think we're evolving in our understanding of how we can use. So when I first meet a patient, I will usually set this whole, there's usually about 7 items on the menu that people will have read about or heard about. And I'll usually draw a little grid for them and say, this is a treatment option. This is appropriate for you. Yes, no. And why?
Thank you for that. And would you mind walking me through the so-called treatment menu?
So in terms of curative liver-directed therapy, the age-old gold standard ever since the Milan criteria came out has been transplantation for patients with HCC, because that gives us the most durable long-term survival from the cancer. It's only appropriate for a certain number of patients with a confined disease, meeting either Milan or UCSF criteria. And so for some patients, that won't be an option. For early stage HCC and patients with very good liver function, that maybe transplant is overkill. Maybe it's not the right first step, because patients, especially with tumors under 2 centimeters, who have very good liver function, they can undergo either an ablation or a surgery and expect to have durable long-term cure. There are some nuances to that, whether the cancer started because they had liver damage due to alcoholism or whether the cancer started because they had a viral infection can sort of determine the level of success for that choice. But you don't always have to go straight to transplant, even if you have early stage disease. So that brings me to 2 other additional menu items. So resection and ablation. So typically ablation is something that we're not going to use for tumors that are over 5 centimeters in size. And really over 3 centimeters, we start to worry that we're not going to be able to kill it all with ablation. Ablation can be done through the skin or with minimally invasive small incisions in most cases. And so usually if we're talking about a tumor over 2 centimeters, ablation is something that we're going to use if we're not going to the operating room. Generally speaking, if we can take something out and they're not a candidate and the patient is not a candidate for transplant, then we're going to take it out. Our second to last curative intent, locally directed therapy is surgical intervention. And that can happen for tumors in a wide variety of settings. We generally will only be offering surgery for patients who have one tumor. When patients start having more tumors, we start worrying that we can take out the thing we can see, but there's probably some things we can't see in the rest of the liver if we have more than 1 or 2 tumors ongoing. So and then the last possibly curative liver-directed therapy is something called SBRT, where we aim electrons at a tumor. That is something that can be curative when we're under 2 centimeters, and then over 2 centimeters, we run into the same problems we run into with ablation, where the control rates are great, but they're not 100%. And so a lot of times patients don't want to take that gamble if a surgery is possibly on the table. So that's our locally directed therapy options that are intended for cure. Sometimes we get into a scenario where a patient might be a candidate for transplant one day if their tumor can get smaller, or where they're not a good candidate for surgery for whatever reason, whether it be a medical problem, overall frailty, or the liver's not healthy enough to withstand surgery. In those instances, we have basically one type of weapon, but three things we can do with it. So we can go through the artery, which is a blood vessel that goes to most tumors, and we can block it off by one of three means. We can do it with, we call it a bland embolization, so meaning we just block it off, we don't leave anything behind. We can put chemotherapy beads in there, that's called TACE, or we can put radioactive spheres in there, that's called Y90. Other people call that Sirtex. There's a lot of different brand names that can go, or several different, not a lot, but several different brand names they can go by. And there's a lot of very strong feelings on each side of what should be done. And a lot of where we're going to land depends on what we're using those arterial treatments as a bridge to, or kind of where we're trying to kick that can, right? So if we're trying to bridge to transplant, many times, if we're in a region where organs are more widely available, we're probably going to pick a bland embolization because that's going to not really make our lives harder down the line. And there's been some great data to show that the bland embolization versus chemo embolization, there's not a big difference. But if we're in a region where we might have to wait longer for a liver, I think we're seeing a pendulum swing towards Y90 because we do tend to see a little bit more of a vigorous response. I don't have data to back that up. That's an anecdotal statement to the Y90. So there is, I think, some growing enthusiasm for that, both as a definitive treatment and as a bridge to transplant. Now, Y90 proponents hearing this would say you can actually do really kill the tumor and do something called a radiation lobectomy, where you basically block off every blood vessel to the tumor and send radiation beads there. And that is an evolving set of data that I don't think are ready for prime time and for recommendations. So we don't routinely make recommendations for the so-called radiation lobectomy or radiation segmentectomy outside of very selected cases where patients can't tolerate surgery. And then lastly, we have systemic therapy, which, like I said earlier, can be used in lots of different ways. Generally, in our practice, we use that for patients who have more than one tumor and who maybe aren't a candidate for transplantation. And we have pretty good response rates to that systemic therapy. So that's a combination of an immunotherapy and a targeted therapy that blocks blood vessel growth. And that has really nice responses. And occasionally, we can get patients to a place where they're ready now to have, they've transitioned from a, hey, I have multifocal disease, I have more than one tumor, and I'm not appropriate to have any form of liver-directed therapy right now, to I've been stable and I've had a great response, and either I'm durably cured, which is some amazing responses that we see to this regimen, or my tumors are now such that they're small enough, they're only occupying one area of the liver, and I'm a candidate for a resection, or in some cases, also now I'm a candidate for transplantation.
That was an excellent and very comprehensive answer. Thank you for that. And what updates from recent publications, conferences, and research have been particularly interesting in the space?
Yeah, so I would say where we're seeing growth is in several arenas. We're always continuing to push the envelope in what's possible surgically. Within the last 5 to 7 years, there has been a push from some of our colleagues in Eastern care markets, so our colleagues in China and Japan and Korea, to really push the envelope on what's possible in terms of liver function and surgery. So it used to be there, we use something called the Child's Pugh classification. And I should say, because I was trained at Michigan, it's actually the Child's Charcot-Pugh classification, because Dr. Charcot was at Michigan. But there's Child's A, B, and C. A is preserved liver function. So that person is going to mostly live a normal life and probably isn't going to have their life shortened very much by their liver disease. You have Child's B, where you have some wiggle room, but if you treat them poorly, their liver can get kind of knocked into a more severe category. And then you have Child C, where basically that patient's life is entirely dictated by their liver disease. And so in a child, it used to be thought it was not okay to do surgery on a Child's B patient. And so there had been some larger scale data coming out from various surgical groups, first an Eastern series, and now there are some Western series to back it up, that or to confirm it, I should say, that it's okay to operate on patients with Child's B cirrhosis, that you're not gonna automatically kick them into a setting where they're gonna die of their liver disease. So that's been one advancement from a surgical standpoint. Obviously, we continue to see advances in what's possible with minimally invasive surgery. So we're seeing a lot more series with laparoscopic and robotic liver surgery coming out. I think the growth in that has been one of the last frontiers of minimally invasive surgery, mostly because the instrumentation for robotic, at least, has not been able to mirror what's possible open. And the skill that's required to do safe laparoscopic liver surgery is quite immense. And so we have had very slow adoption of minimally invasive liver surgery kind of globally. But I think at least in the US, we're seeing significant growth now to match our Eastern and European colleagues with minimally invasive liver surgery. So that's enough. Those are our two kind of surgical arenas. On the transplant side of things, I think the envelope continues to be pushed with what they call expanded criteria. And then also with donor, with mar what they call marginal donors. So, you know, using hepatitis positive donors, using machines that actually put marginal livers on a pump to make sure that it's okay, and then putting it in. And so seeing a lot of advancements there that are turning liver transplant surgery into a higher volume and more sustainable pursuit, so that we have that option, more that option for more patients. On the liver-directed therapy side of things, so that curative intent, aiming just at the tumors that we can see, we are seeing a lot more enthusiasm in our patients that we can't do surgery on for kind of combinations of, let's do Y90, let's think about doing a radiation segmentectomy, and let's give immunotherapy at the same time, and let's see where we land. Or let's do this, and while we're waiting for it to take effect, if we're using it as a possible bridge to something else, we can do some immunotherapy. There's been some more studies, you know, initially because patients have to be immunosuppressed following transplantation, there was some initial hesitancy towards giving patients that may one day come to transplant immunotherapy. We have an ongoing and growing, somewhat mixed body of data, mostly landing on the idea that that's okay, that it's okay to give the immunotherapy up front and then transplant them and immunosuppress them, and that they do quite well. So that's on that side of things. And then lastly, I would say just we're continuing to see an explosion of medical agents aimed at the kind of the systemic therapy. So for those patients that are not candidates for any of those treatments that might have curative intent or might be a bridge to curative intent, those are the patients where we really have the most opportunity for growth and for improvement in care. And so in addition to the I'm Brave trial, where we have that combination of an immunotherapy, that the atezolizumab anti-PD-L1 and the bevacizumab, which is targeting new blood vessel growth. So that combination, we have a number of other now approved, one other now approved combination of immunotherapy as second line, and then additional things coming down the pike every day. And then I guess in addition to that, so how we use the systemic therapy is also being evaluated. So there has been a phase 1b trial reported using atezolizumab and bevacizumab as what we call neoadjuvant. So using that therapy to try and help us get into the operating room and to do that intentionally, right? So before, in practice, sometimes it just happens accidentally where you're like, gosh, that's a really bad set of tumors. I can't do anything for them surgically. I'm gonna send them off to the medical oncologist, and the medical oncologist calls you back 6 to 9 months later, and they're like, I need you to look at this scan, and you wouldn't believe it's the same patient. And then all of a sudden, now everyone has more enthusiasm for surgical treatment. So trying to figure out who might that work for, especially when we're seeing patients who might be have very large tumors that are pushing on kind of important liver structures. And to start out, I'm going to have to do a right hepatectomy or an extended right hepatectomy where they're going to be left with very little liver remnant. And now, is there room for us to shrink that tumor with immunotherapy so that I can do a less extensive resection? And that is something that the field needs to figure out. What's next for that? Because right now, nobody wants to miss their window. Like, if it's possible to possibly remove the tumor, you don't want to say, "Hey, let me pump the brakes and see if we can do something," because there's a 60% chance that it'll help you. Not a lot of people will take those odds if there's already an option for surgery. So I think that's where our next kind of two places to push the envelope will be, is optimal type of therapy. So we've got our atezo-bev regimen that everybody loves. But are there things that might work better? Is there a combination of things that might work better? And is there, an order of things that might work better?
Great, thank you so much. And to switch from the positives and advances, would you discuss some of the unmet needs that remain a challenge in this space?
First and foremost, I think accurate and regular surveillance for patients who are at high risk for liver cancer is an extremely underappreciated piece of this. We know and have known for a long time, especially in terms of viral patients carrying hepatitis B and C, who should be surveilled. Obviously, most of our hepatitis C patients are now being cured, but our hep B carriers need to be surveilled. And I think many times, especially in the United States, we are not as adept at establishing regular surveillance and keeping patients plugged in to the surveillance that they need. And beyond that, I can't tell you the number of patients I've seen with liver tumors that are large that were visible on a screening exam that was called negative. So high quality screening, but also having somebody on the other end of that screening exam who looks at livers on a regular basis, I think is something that's very important, not leaving that up to non-specialty providers, and just making sure that access to liver, good liver care and good liver imaging is more prevalent for our patients. I think that's one very important piece that is often overlooked. And some of that is that liver cancer tends to be a disease of patients with less fortunate backgrounds, right? So, hep B and hep C unmitigated and unknown infections and carrying is something that we see in patients with lower socioeconomic status. Same thing with alcoholic cirrhosis, right? That's not typically a disease for the very wealthy. It can be, but it's not typical. And last, the last frontier, of course, with the non-alcoholic steatohepatic liver disease, or now very recently, we have worked hard, our hepatology colleagues have worked hard to change the nomenclature around liver disease to make it less stigmatizing. So rather than saying alcoholic cirrhosis or fatty liver, we've had now updated terminology. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is now metabolic associated steatotic liver disease. Metabolic associated steatotic liver disease who drink alcohol is now going to be called MET ALD. And then alcohol-related liver disease is ALD, so instead of alcoholic cirrhosis. So trying to just kind of destigmatize some of these things for patients so that they, when they are there seeking treatment, that they're better off. So that leads me to my last thing that I was going to say, which is I think one of our last remaining frontiers is identifying those patients with metabolic associated steatotic liver disease or steatotic liver disease for any reason, who is actually at risk for developing cancer. So that's, I think, the last remaining frontier. And with the obesity epidemic rising in the United States, and with many of our patients who are especially underserved living in food deserts where they don't have access to fresh food, and they are have you know they are consuming large amounts of processed foods that will absolutely increase their risk for steatotic liver disease. Which of those patients would benefit the most from being enrolled in a screening program? Which of those patients are at highest risk for developing cancer? And then from there, how can you treat them? So that's another big area of exploration right now, too, is the actual source of the liver cancer, who benefits from the immunotherapy based upon the source of the liver cancer. And you know, some evidence to suggest that doesn't work great for patients who have steatotic liver disease. And so we really need to focus in more on that, because what we don't want is for our patients from already underserved backgrounds to be bankrupting themselves for a treatment that may not be of benefit to them. So lots going on. but those are what I say our final frontiers, or our newest frontiers, would be those three things.
Thank you for that. And how do you expect the HCC field to shift in the coming years?
Looking forward.
That's such a good question. I think that we're going to continue to see more people being cured in a less invasive way. And whether that be with, and I do think we'll see more people treated with some combination of systemic therapy and liver-directed therapy, whether that be surgery or some other form of you know, through the skin of minimally invasive liver-directed therapy remains to be seen. But yeah, that's what I hope. I hope we see more people being cured in a less invasive manner. And I do think that, unfortunately, that we will see an incidence increase and a continued incidence increase, especially in the United States, from our ongoing epidemic of steatotic liver disease. I hope that as we have this kind of groundswell of support for serving our underserved communities, that we will continue to see innovation in screening, which will unfortunately drive an increased incidence, but hopefully would also drive improved outcomes for our patients.
And what are some key recommendations you could provide to a community oncologist wanting to know a little more about the field of liver cancer for Liver Cancer Awareness Month?
Yeah, so for community oncologists to take away, I would say the most important thing is get your patient to a high volume, or get your patient's scans in front of a high volume liver center. Because many, many times we see patients who may have been appropriate for some form of liver-directed therapy who were not offered liver-directed therapy. And conversely, we see a lot of patients who are thought to be candidates for surgical intervention, who, once they have liver-specific imaging, are found to have multifocal disease, who would not have benefited from surgery. So I think the most important thing for community oncologists to understand, or to hear, is to try and engage have the patient seen by a surgeon at a high volume liver center, even if they feel that you know that it may not be possible, that at least touching base with a multidisciplinary care team is a very important thing. The second thing I would say to a community oncologist is every institution has their own personality about what sort of liver-directed therapy they will recommend. And the data regarding, like, comparing ablation versus SBRT versus laparoscopic liver resection versus Y90 are non-existent. So because of that, I think it is very important to make sure that you are quality checking the people to whom you're referring your patients. And that, especially when it comes to Y90, when we have patients who have otherwise compensated liver disease, we have to make sure that it's highly selective. Because if we're doing low bar Y90 for multifocal HCC in a patient with already, you know, poor liver function, those are the patients that we wind up seeing do very poorly, who are no longer a candidate for any services. I think it's important for a surgeon to be involved in every liver cancer patient's journey at least once. I think there is no substitute for high quality liver specific imaging. When in doubt, engage your friendly neighborhood person who looks at livers a lot.
Wonderful, thank you. And do you have any closing thoughts or anything you would like to add regarding your own work?
I think the thing that we're doing here that I'm really proud of is working together as a team, and is really trying to find the right way forward for each patient. With, you know, with so many different things on the menu, it's really, really easy for physicians and for communities of physicians to fall into referral patterns that are more comfortable than they are beneficial. And it's also very easy to start doing things that feel good, maybe, but maybe don't do good. And so I think it's extremely important to what I'm very proud of the fact that we've cultivated here a multidisciplinary environment where the only person that needs to win is the patient. And we work really hard to build very good practice agreements around kind of whose lane is where, so that we can all function optimally at the top of our game with the ultimate goal of making the exact right choice for each patient. So that's, I think, the thing I'm most proud of is how well we work together as a team.